Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everybody. This is Rick, and it is November the 18th, and you're listening to the Q&A EMSO, EMS, and library call today. We have two questions, and thank you for those who've called in or are listening live. We'll also have these posted shortly. So our first question today is on accountability. You had a question last week pertaining to accountability. It discussed inner circle behaviors and when they should be disclosed to a spouse, not just an accountability partner. My question is, what is normal sexual temptation for a man, and when do you know an accountability partner is necessary? Seems like almost every man would need an accountability partner in the world we live in now. Second question, is what is appropriate conduct with opposite sex, what is appropriate conduct with opposite sex coworkers? I notice in both mine and my husband's workplace many people cross boundaries and with each other that is inappropriate and could lay the groundwork for infidelity. How over extended period of years do you continue to keep these people shut out and at arm's length? Thanks again. So, it depends on exactly how you define temptation. So I think I mentioned last week, people are going to notice things, and I look at it as almost a five-step process. You notice something in a sexual way. That is not necessarily a temptation. Depending on the environment you're in, I mean, there could be up to 100 of things that a guy could notice in a single day. At that point, there is no desire to do anything. It's just something noticed in a sexual way. The second stage is when someone notices something in a sexual way and they begin to give it airtime, letting it, what I'd call almost dehumanizing that person, just kind of glancing at them long enough to kind of get sexual pleasure. I mean, to me, that's when somebody begins to violate the three-second rule. The person that's really tempting, where you're tempted to just look, I don't know that one is serious, but when someone begins to cross beyond that three-second piece, there's a temptation at that point to do other things that now become a bigger issue. Those temptations deal with fantasizing about that person, fantasizing about other things. It's not just visual. It's using fantasy. It's a temptation to, again, use things in a sexual way to begin to mood alter, to feel better, to escape, to numb out. The temptation to do that sort of thing, obviously, things are kind of becoming a problem at that point. If ever there were a place where maybe what we call lust begins to kick in, because now, truly, there's that objectification, dehumanizing, disrobing, whatever. The temptation to do that, if it's really strong, and especially with an ongoing person, I think that that's the type of thing that needs to be talked with other guys, that you keep that stuff out front. I mean, that's where you make a covenant with your eyes. I mean, I don't want to use people. And the problem with that sort of temptation, it's really beginning to use a person for my own satisfaction. And in my mind, that's going to be the place where I'm not acting in a loving way anymore. And I'm not even really seeing that person as a person. I'm seeing them as an object. And so I would hope that when somebody gets to that point, or they're tempted to do that on a regular basis, that that's where they're talking to someone, or if there's somebody that is a temptation, or if they're really struggling with temptation to look somebody up in particular on the internet or things like that. Those are temptations to behaviors that I think would be dangerous, and it would be really good for them to be sharing. So being in a group where you can talk about things is a good thing. And so I guess when you say normal sexual temptation, noticing things in a sexual way, that's maybe what you're referring to in my mind is normal. That's just going to happen. It's what you do after you notice something. Are you going to begin to give it airtime? And that's where the battle is really first fought and needs to be fought. Because at that level, if someone will stay pure with their eyes, make a covenant with their eyes, one of the prayers, I think I mentioned this last week, that I pray, if I see somebody that, you know, is tempting in a sense, I'll just sit there and say, you know, I would rather suffer for her benefit than gratify myself at her expense. I mean, I don't want to use people. To me, that level of temptation, though, to look somebody up, to go up and talk to someone, those temptations, for I want to act on something, fantasize, that's when it gets really big, and I hope that we would, you know, talk with others about that stuff. The second question is, what is appropriate conduct with opposite sex coworkers? I notice both in both mine and husband's workplace, many people cross boundaries with each other that are inappropriate and could lay the groundwork for infidelity. How overextended periods of time or of years do you continue to keep these people shut out and at arm's length? Thanks again. That's a great question. And on that one, to me, it's really a matter of treating people with respect. And I guess it comes down to what I refer to as grooming behaviors. If my goal with somebody at work is to almost be their answer, and this is like opposite sex stuff, if I'm trying to be an encourager to help them out, if I'm trying to be a listening ear, those are the roles, I think, in the workplace that become very, very iffy. I mean, it's fine to say, great job, but if you're doing things like a lot of compliments, not about work, but especially about how they look, the ways, things that are not work-related, that's a huge one. To me, anytime you begin to cross boundaries where you talk about things other than work-related items, that's probably going to be an issue. Keeping the conversations professional, I think that's really important. Being careful to not show favoritism to one person over another person, that's a huge boundary. Setting an example by never having lunches, but, you know, alone, but always keeping things in a group so that you state or you're showing by example that you're careful with your boundaries. Believe it or not, not showing more interest to one person than another person. I think, again, maybe that's that showing preference. I think it's a matter in the workplace of treating them with respect, but also of protecting them and their fidelity as well as yours. And in that respect, just being concerned for other people. If they have questions, people of the opposite sex, I highly recommend you maybe about a life situation, let them find a good referral for them. Our problem in what I call grooming behaviors is when we begin to try to be the solution for someone, for instance, if they have a low self-esteem, we'll start complimenting them all the time. It looks good on the outside. I call that pimping tenderness. But at the same time, it can make a person very dependent on your actions toward them. So not saying you should be cruel or cold, but again, make sure that there's a very, very clear boundary. And at that point, the other person will catch on and make it your boundary. Don't make it theirs. If they want to go spend time with you, sit there and say, you know, that one of your rules to protect your family is that you don't do that sort of thing. And no physical touch. I think that's a huge thing. Handshakes are fine, but other than that, keep it very professional. And I would hope, you know, usually I find if people are conscious about those boundaries of, you know, that being just kind to somebody because it looks like they need someone who's kind to them, hopefully you can encourage another woman to do that for them. Or if you're a guy or if you're a woman, you can encourage another guy. But don't try to be the source. All you're trying to do is help people find the source. And when you're pointing them to the right direction and not trying to be the solution, but trying to, again, let's say, trying to teach them how to fish rather than being the fish, giving them the fish, that's going to be a better solution. Next, looks like week 5, confusion. I'm going to do my best to make this as short as I can. I've been together 9 years, found out about the first affair 2 months in. Since that time, I've had at least 6 more D-days and physical affairs, and I would say at least 50 cases of what you'd call infidelity. My husband was a drug addict and alcoholic and also physically abusive, and I would say, and I was the fool who stayed with him after every single time I found out about yet another affair. Each time I would say, if you do it again, I'm gone. Then he would, and I would stay. Counselor after counselor told me I was ill and needed to leave him and not to subject myself to the marital abuse. 4 years ago, we found God and our lives changed. Over the next 2 years, God took the drugs and alcohol, and I saw a man I'd never known, the man I dreamed of. I thought I was done being hurt, and we were married September 2011, only to discover 3 weeks later that he had been living a lie and having yet another affair. He confessed to a porn addiction. Once again, I took him back. Actually, felt like this time I was right because we had God now and we could heal. Well, since then, I haven't found out about any more physical affairs, but definitely there have been betrayals, and he's lied many times, the worst being this past June. I feel like the counselors are right, and I must be sick to put up with this for 9 years, and now chance number 300, and we're trying this course. You talk about in this DVD this week about PTSD, and well, maybe I have that because I have triggers all the time and feel like this is getting worse, not better. My relationship with God has grown huge, but during this time, my relationship with my husband is getting worse. The more I feel God loves me, the more I feel like I don't allow myself to hurt like this anymore, because the love I keep waiting for my husband to give me is something Jesus can. I feel myself becoming more distant and protectful of my heart. I truly don't believe he loves me because of all he's done. Everything he does irritates me, and the selfless love I used to have for him, I don't feel anymore. Every time a thought comes into my mind to do something loving for him or to him, I automatically fight it. I think my mind just automatically wants to protect me from any more hurt. I fear I've reached the point that after hundreds of hurts and lies and betrayals, and hundreds is not an understatement, my brain just wants to protect itself. Is that possible? Second, the homework this week made no sense to me. The first part says, I feel, but I know the truth. Well, when I have a reminder, I feel hurt, that is the truth. And I feel, and what I feel and what I believe are the same. When I have a reminder, I tell my husband, and he reacts in anger almost every time, or he defends his actions and makes excuses. Reminders don't make me feel anything except that I wish my husband would love me. So when the book says, take a reminder, seeing as AP, and pick a harmful temptation or desire that arises from that reminder, then use the life model. There is no harmful desire or temptation. The only desire I have from any of the reminders on my list is that I wish and want my husband to love me. I can't put any of those in the life model. I don't get it. Reminders make me go to my husband and tell him how the reminder made me feel, and each time I still think maybe just this once he'll empathize, but he never does. How does this fit in with the life cycle? Okay. That is a great question. First off, let me say, the very fact that when you bring up a reminder, he gets defensive or angry would say that most likely in my opinion, he is not in a good place, and he's probably still not safe for a relationship with you. And so the part of you that feels like he's not safe is spot on. Because without empathy, there's really no way to feel like the two of you, or to feel like you matter to him. If he can't put himself in your shoes, how can you ever know or feel like he gets what's happening inside of you? Because we all want to know that we matter, and that the other person is willing to try to understand our perspective and is grieved over what their actions ultimately have cost us. And so it's a concern to me that he doesn't show any grief and that he gets defensive and angry, which would just say to me he's still probably not in recovery. Another thing you said here is that you just wish he would love you. And I would bet the truth would be you wish he would love you about a tenth as much as you love him. And basically, codependent relationships, what your counselors, I think, were talking about at the beginning of this question, the one great way to describe them is as one-way relationships, where you keep loving, hoping desperately they will love you back just a tenth as much as you love them, that at one level you're addicted to that one little bit when there's hope, and you keep striving and stretching for hope. I think in to answer your question about the hurt model, the example of hurt, not the hurt model, but the example of hurt, where you feel hurt and that's the truth. So really, to me, it would be more of a feeling like how I need to respond. In other words, I know that he's not in recovery, but I still think if I love him the most, I feel like if I love him enough, eventually he'll come back to me. Or I still feel this. And I'm thinking you would flip that if you go, you know, I feel like I should stay with him at this point and try to work things out since we have God now, but I know that he's still showing a lack of, but the truth is he's still showing a lack of empathy and is going to probably continue down this path. I feel like I've got a lot of time invested in this and that I really don't need to give up at this point. But the truth is, it seems that there's no matter how much time I give this, if God doesn't change him, nothing's going to happen. So maybe I need to give up hope that things will change. Maybe those are silly examples, but to me it's not just a feeling per se. It's kind of what the actions that are being driven by the feelings. In terms of the temptation or the life model, so if one of the problems you identify is I keep, as the counselors say, I keep giving him a second chance, so you could label that, I still want to give him a second chance, that would be the action, but that's my old nature. I'm really a saint. I'm a child of God. I know that love acts in the best interest of another person. So rather than focusing on that, then you focus on what do I need to do to become the woman that God made me to be, that's kind of my new goal, and you shift behaviors. Or maybe in the labeling, you might go, one of the things I do is I keep expecting him to respond differently and have an empathetic response. You know, I think, so the label might go, I feel like I need to go share my hurt about this trigger, identity, but I'm a saint. I've already got what I need from God. I know to do that once again is going to result in the same thing. So I shift the focus rather than trying to go to him and tell him about the feeling and getting crushed again. Now I shift the focus and I begin maybe praying and having God change me. It's really, what are the behaviors or the response patterns that you would want to change with Him? And because if you know that going and sharing triggers, for instance, is not helpful because He always does the same thing, then you would want to stop sharing the triggers at one level and just say, why do I want to put myself out there to be hurt again, and attempt something completely different, which would be, you know, leaving Him alone. As you say, there's a part of you that's backing away the closer you get to God. To me, that sounds like that may be God, that might be a very wise thing. I don't know, but I would guard your heart. Again, if he's still being, at the end of the course, defensive and reactive, and you bring something up, then maybe you need to say, I've got to keep focused on things other than him to fill me up. I hope that answers that question a little bit. And post again next week, and I'll try again if that's not everything you want. Last question, sexual addiction. How can I love my husband who is into sick and perverse role-playing online, sexting, cyber sex, Skype sex, etc.? How can I respect him and even think that we can ever again be intimate? So I guess I don't quite have enough information here, but it would depend. If he is still doing that, I would say I don't see any way that that could happen. If, on the other hand, he goes into recovery and begins addressing all of that, then there is potential. But with sexual addiction, if somebody's not in recovery, I don't know that it's really safe. And you don't know for a long time, I think, with sexual addiction, how, you know, you want to see over time a continued pattern of recovery and that somebody's doing what's necessary, that they stay in a place of concern and they're able to be concerned for you and they're grieved over what they've done to you, not just trying to save the marriage, but instead they're in a place of just instead concern and grief. If they're not doing recovery after they've been into that sort of thing, I can tell you they're not safe. If they're in recovery, I know that it seems impossible that you could even be attracted to someone like that again, and maybe you can't. I know many, many people, when their mate goes into recovery and begins to get straightened out again, are able to find a great love for them again, and in fact, a tremendous respect. But it takes a lot of work between you and your mate to understand why that was going on, to know that it's safe and not going on, that they've chosen you over that behavior before you know you can ever come to a place of being together again. It's almost like they have to be willing to kind of reformat their own hard drive, sexual hard drive, to figure out what they need, what they want, how they need to live so that you can be safe and so the two of you could be connected again. And it would also require for that to happen, you to do your own recovery work and going to COSA, doing Harboring Hope, whatever is necessary for you to begin also to understand more about sexual addiction and what roles you played in that, not that you caused any of it, but how this has impacted the marriage. Because just like with alcoholism, if there's an alcoholic, I guarantee you it's a family disease. Everybody at one level is impacted, and what would need to change, and you know how things have been distorted as a result of that, and that would be your recovery work too. So I believe that is all of our questions. I want to thank everybody for calling in, and for those of you who wrote questions down today. And I hope you'll keep those questions coming, and we'll talk again next Monday to healing.